Ordo Ab Kael. We'll just devolve everything into a state of chaos, and out of that we will bring order to the world the way we want it. And everybody will get down on their knees and thank us for restoring order and security to their lives. And they will be willing to give up anything to us for that favor.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Could the entire professional academic history of Western civilization be wrong? Could it be based on Babylon, not Greek civilization? He who controls the present controls the past, and who controls the past controls the future. If George Orwell was right, our entire view of history is wrong. So we listen tonight to William Stewart on wars being planned well before they happened, and also on the East India Company's role in creating the British Empire, a private company. Also, in the plans for supercomputers on the day that the world's first computer mimicking the human brain is switched on, David Livingstone, on the twisting of history of Western civilization taught in our universities. That's the bigger picture, but we're also talking about the Lion Air crash in Jakarta, Indonesia. Why did a brand new airliner perform a power dive into the sea from 6,000 feet? Is that even possible? Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM, Tuesday at noon this week. The Bristol bus protest petition organiser, Max Langan. We have a full interview with him, as well as the full interview with the clip we heard last week with International Court lawyer, criminal lawyer, Christopher Black. Listen here on BCFM at 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download it from now from dialectradio.co.uk. We start, Martin, with this attack on the synagogue in Pittsburgh the weekend. I think a particularly horrific attack. But today we hear that the chap who's been accused of it is going to plead not guilty. I mean, this is the worst, apparently, attack, anti-Semitic attack in US history.
Well, yes, it's all very, very sad and reprehensible, isn't it? I mean, the guy's pleaded not guilty. It's possible that he's been set up. Things like that do happen in the United States. It's actually, you know, as we know, we've discussed many times, 9/11 was not what it appears, and things can often be something other than what they appear. But there's no point jumping to conclusions. If he's pleaded not guilty, there's going to be a trial. We'll have to see what comes out.
So what do you make of the whole anti-Semitic feeling? Is this simply people getting annoyed with the American foreign policy being so closely allied to that? Things like the moving of the embassy to Jerusalem, that kind of thing?
I don't think that. I think somebody that carried out an act like this, it's not related to what you might call mainstream politics at all. It's an act of hatred, and it's to be condemned as an act of hatred. I don't accept that there is a political justification for such things. And, you know, I don't think anything the State of Israel's done, and far be it from me to pull any criticism on me. You know, I think they should be criticised to the hilt. But that doesn't mean you can walk into a synagogue and kill people. That's completely unacceptable.
What about this? Is something that the mainstream press very, very rarely seem to talk about, and that is that we always seem to see an increase in these sorts of incidents in the run-up to elections.
Well, the fear has to be that the secret services in the US and billionaires and others,
and possibly abroad.
Well, and possibly, you know, the Saudis and the Israelis do play big. They put a lot of effort into steering US politics in the direction they want it to go. The Russians basically are observers. It's the Israelis and the Saudis that that spend all the money.
Well, we're going to be
hearing. And of course, the elections are rigged in the West, but they're rigged by our own secret services. They're not rigged by foreign secret services.
Well, we're going to be
hearing. It's the CIA and MI6 that people need to be looking at.
We'll be hearing a little bit later, Hope, from David Livingston about something called Le Cercle, which is an organisation completely unofficial. Well, you could even call it an NGO, but it's made up mostly of retired government right-wing intelligence people, as well as apparently some of them are actually still serving in the armed forces in the West. And it consists mostly of the right wing of the intelligence services across Europe. Le Cercle, who are these people? And this does strike me as the sort of thing that they would probably have something to say about if they only had a phone number and a press spokesperson we could ask.
I mean, it strikes me as very similar to the Safari Club, which was set up by the French secret services in the 1980s as a means for the CIA to carry on doing the things it was doing all over the world, because the Church Committee had basically said that they got to stop doing their nefarious activities, and the Safari Club was set up by the French secret services, and the British, of course, were involved, so that they could do all the things they were going to do anyway, but we'll do it with the other secret services. And, for example, the Operation Cyclone, the funding and training of Al-Qaeda to fight inside Afghanistan, which was Britain was the lead agency on in that period, which is why the Limited Islamic Fighting Group are based in Manchester. These people are very active, and the former head of the MI6 has come out and said that Jeremy Corbyn is not a suitable person to be Prime Minister. He's supposed to be a civil servant. It's extraordinary that he feels his job description as a retired head of MI6 is to say who we're going to vote for at the election. Shocking, but there it is, and it just shows how powerful they seem to think they are.
Robert Bowers, the alleged gunman accused of killing 11 Jewish worshippers at a Pittsburgh synagogue on Saturday, has pleaded not guilty. Mr. Bowers, 46, has requested a jury trial. Authorities called the attack on the Tree of Life synagogue the worst anti-Semitic incident in US history. US media also reported Mr. Bowers entered the courtroom without a wheelchair, bandaged on the arm from the injuries suffering during a shootout with police on Saturday, allegedly. With a loud yes, Mr. Bowers confirmed he'd read the indictment and understood the charges against him. He reportedly had no reaction when told he faced the death penalty. The federal indictment alleges Mr. Bowers walked into the synagogue with multiple firearms, ranted about wanting to kill Jews, and then began gunning down worshippers as well as firing on police when they arrived. During his first court appearance, he was in a wheelchair and he spoke little. On Wednesday, the US prosecutors added a further 15 charges to the 29 he already faces, making a total of 44. Assaulting police officers, these charges were, and special findings to support the case for pursuing the death penalty. According to an affidavit, Mr. Bowers told police immediately after arrest that he wanted all Jews to die in an affidavit. But the problem, of course, with things like this is the incident has happened, it's reported, but it won't be until after the election's over that there's any kind of verdict.
Well, and of course, there's been the other things, the pipe bomb scare, and all the rest of it. But we're right to be suspicious, because elections are manipulated by in all kinds of different ways, but not by the Russians, which is frankly silly. They haven't got the resources nor the inclination. The people who are trying to fix elections are the people who've always fixed elections. The circle you mentioned earlier, and people of that sort, you know, billionaires, spooks, and military.
Well,
they're the ones who, and that's our spooks and military.
As the midterm elections are coming up in the US in a few days, we're also seeing this caravan coming up from Honduras up through Mexico. Mm-hmm. I mean, I must say, when I saw that, I thought, well, who's organised this? This is all very well timed for the US elections, and I wonder what you make of that. We've had Trump today, or maybe it was yesterday, saying that, well, if people want to throw rocks at the Americans at the border, then they may well find themselves being shot with guns and bullets in return.
Well, I mean, you've got to ask yourself the question, qui bono? The elections are coming up. If this is a stunt to try and influence the elections, it's actually going to help Trump, because Trump's the one who wants it, and the Republicans want it to be about immigration. So this caravan makes it about immigration.
But do you think
although
Trump
the right wing are suggesting that Soros has funded all of these people to come march up from Honduras. And, of course, people forget that there was a military coup in Honduras during the Obama administration, which basically drove out a Zelaya, who was the left-wing president, and then the follow-on, I can't remember the name of who's in charge there now, but they've killed quite a lot of people. Trade unionists, ecological activists, and so on, have all been killed. And so we say, why should the Hondurans want to come to America? Because you've just overthrown their government and put a fascist jackboot in their face, and they're turning up on your doorstep saying, hang on a minute, you just overthrew our government. Now we're turning up on your doorstep saying, do something to help us. And the whole thing about this is incredible. If there is a collapse, as there already has been a collapse in the society in Central America, then these people are going to get on the road. Of course they are. And if you carry on bombing them, killing them, and of course Central America was absolutely devastated in the 1980s in Nicaragua, where there were 30,000 civilians killed by the Contras, who were supported by the US and by the British. And of course they eventually drove the Sandinistas from power. And that's what goes on. That's the real world.
But they're going to be claiming, apparently, the migrant caravan members call Trump our president, according to the Daily Mail today, and sue him for saying they can't apply for asylum, aided by US lawyers linked to a firm that profits by posting immigrants' bail. Six Honduran migrants and their five children have sued the Trump administration yesterday when they were walking through North Mexico. They called Trump our president and accused him of unconstitutional conduct. Lawyers are part of the non-profit arm of a company that gets immigrants to bail them out from detention and uses GPS monitoring services. So effectively they're saying that they're going up to America to claim asylum. And so the idea that Trump is saying that they can't apply for asylum before they've even turned up, they're taking him to court as a preemptive strike, I suppose. They say he's our president.
Well, I hear what you say, Tony. I'm just pointing out that most people in mainstream media haven't mentioned that there was a military coup in Honduras, where they're supposedly all coming from.
Well, this is why...
And that was backed by the Americans. The Americans overthrew the democratically elected government of Honduras.
This is why they're applying for asylum. They're not just refugees. Well, they're refugees rather than economic migrants.
Well, the point is, if you're going to march to the border in a big crowd like that, the chances of getting over are virtually zero. And of course there's loads of people getting over all the time, but they don't do it by marching along in a huge crowd like that. They just sneak over. And these problems are going to continue. Central America was devastated by US intervention in the 80s and the 90s. Absolutely devastated. And if you're going to devastate, Haiti was devastated. They still haven't got a democratic government in Haiti because the Americans overthrew it. And of course, if anybody from Haiti tries to get on a boat to go into the United States, they're immediately picked up by the Coast Guard and told to go home. But if you escape from Cuba, you immediately get British US citizenship as soon as you land on American soil, because it's all about trying to destabilise Castro.
CNN are saying we have nothing to fear from the migrant march. Alice Driver on CNN, she says 27 days old Rachel apparently travelled 316 miles with the migrant caravan, mostly in her mother's arms. The pair left Guatemala with Yesenia's husband Ernesto, their 4 and 6 year old daughters. He recently lost his job, she was unemployed. They were afraid of not being able to provide basic necessity for their children. Although the couple admitted it had been difficult to read the news that President Trump would send troops to the border, they hope to request asylum in the United States and pray that God will help the president understand the hardships that they've lived through. So a lot of this actually is surely a result of US foreign policy in South America.
It is.
And Central America.
It is. Of course it is. Just as the 60,000 deaths in the drug war in Brazil have helped to the far right to an electoral victory there, because the CIA, as Pablo Escobar's son said in Colombia not long ago, was working with the CIA for years and years and years. Now the fact is, the US dominates the globe and dominates South America and Central America, dominates Mexico, dominates the Middle East. And then when people complain about what goes on, they say, well, hang on a minute, you can't come here, even though we're sticking our finger into everything that goes on in your home countries. We need to actually allow people to do the right things in their home countries, and then they wouldn't need to get on the road and try and find asylum inside the US
itself. The idea that this is some sort of armed group are trying to come to the southern borders of the United States in California, New Mexico, wherever, and force their way in, it doesn't seem to me to be actually what's going on. These people seem to be basically a peaceful protest.
Well, the fact is that they've got no legal right to cross the border, and I presume what will happen when they get to the border is they'll just be told you can't come in, because that's the reality of the real world we really live in. And of course, the fact is out there, the economies in developing countries, that all of the BRICS economies are now in free fall. Turkey's in free fall, Argentina's in free fall, Brazil's in free fall, Mexico's holding up, but of course eventually they're all going to be in free fall, and of course at that point people get on their bikes and look for work, as they're supposed to do. And of course the money just goes over across borders just like that at the flick of a switch. People have to chase that money. In the past, money used to, basically with capital controls from 1945 to 1973, governments could actually steer investment, and then they couldn't do it anymore.
Started with about 7,000 members when it began in San Pedro Sula, Honduras, on the 12th of October, but it continues to shrink. This is in part, according to the UN Refugee Agency, because many of the migrants have requested asylum in Mexico. There's around about 3,500 people left, of which there's estimated 2,300 are children. Now, it doesn't sound to me like they're in any position to try and force their way in. They're just begging for a decent life.
Yeah, and it may be that this is the people supporting this are trying to influence the elections in the US. But of course, insofar as they're dominating the news agenda, they are in fact helping the Republicans rather than the Democrats, although the Republicans are claiming that the Democrats are behind it. I think the fact is that all these people are, there's a lot of misery out there. Because we've had 10 years of austerity and of course hundreds of years of imperialism.
Now, we were talking last week about Brazil and the election of a far-right Bolsonaro. With that whole idea of having somebody like that, I was looking at the news this week, Martin. It seems that Benjamin Netanyahu might want to fly over from Israel for his inauguration.
Yes, because he's like the far right in general are very pro-Israeli these days, because the Israeli state is run by the far right. So there you have
it. And Tommy Robinson is doing a tour apparently of America and Australia. It does bother me that he can't really do a tour of the UK because people here are a bit too wise to him. So the idea is that he's going to try and tour Australia, tour America, misinforming them about how Islam is about to take over Sharia law in those of British cities.
Well, that's right, although we had Ben from UKIP on here last week saying that he didn't want Tommy Robinson inside UKIP. Now, of course, the trouble for the right is the far right is the far right. So, for example, Donald Trump and the Conservative Party here are pro-Bolsonaro, but Bolsonaro is a fascist. So, there's no doubt about it. He's called for the elimination of his political opponents for their murder and torture. But, of course, he's won the election, and therefore the right wing in the West, he's won the election, he must be a good guy. No, he's a fascist
and a murderer. Do you think there is any connection between this and what happened in Pittsburgh on Saturday?
Well, I don't know what happened in Pittsburgh on Saturday, other than a lot of
people
are dead.
Were killed.
Well, indeed, and we don't know the full details. It's quite possible that there is a strategy of tension going on. I'm quite convinced that there is a strategy of tension going on, but individual incidents cannot necessarily be placed as part of that strategy of tension. But I think things that, like the FBI, creating terror plots. I mean, that book that you referenced last week on the webpage,
Rise Up and Kill First.
Well, no, that's the Mossad going out and saying that they've killed 2,000 people in the last decade.
2,700
in the last decade alone.
Preachers journalists and
that's
political
right.
leaders.
So, actual fact, the reality is that Western intelligence services are gangsters, thugs and murderers and drug dealers, and they run things. The elections really are for kiddies. The real power structure, the deep state, is out there, and it's actually run by these kind of thugs who are in cahoots with the billionaires that actually really run the show.
So let's have a listen now. We did do this series a little while ago of listening to various members of the Israeli cabinet, and one of them was over in the United States to talk about this horrific attack in Pittsburgh that happened on Saturday. He's the Israeli Education Minister Naftali Bennett. So let's hear what he has to say now.
First of all, I came as a minister of diaspora Jews of the government of Israel to stand side by side with the American Jewish community and with the United States in this very tough moment, the worst anti-Semite attack in the history of the United States. And I was down in Squirrel Hill in Pittsburgh. It was very, very tough scenes there, a very bad event. So we're here. Now, in Israel, unfortunately, we experience a lot of terror attacks, so we're sort of experienced in that. And there's many things that we can offer to help in terms of the balance between security and continuing life as usual, which is as important. And we'll definitely share our ideas.
What do Jewish institutions, not only synagogues but Jewish schools, have to do to protect themselves? What are they not doing that they need to be doing?
Well, you know, I don't want to come and impose a specific formula. The main thing is awareness, higher awareness. Folks who are not used to this sort of thing, it's a huge shock. Even the minimal degree of awareness can change everything. You know, one good security guard who's alert can prevent a terror attack. That's our experience from Israel. But things are very different here and there in many dimensions. So I think the main thing is to hear the specific needs here and then to see how we can help.
Do you think that armed guards will be necessary at synagogues and Jewish day schools?
In certain synagogues, certain locations, it may be necessary to have armed guards. That's our experience. But we want to continue life. We don't want to impose, you know, the highest degree of security on everything. Not every synagogue can become Fort Knox. We need to live. And that's the precise balance that we need to be talking about.
Well, it's interesting because the costs of the funerals have been raised by Muslim charities in the US. They've raised the money to pay for the funerals of all of those killed. And Hamas has also issued a statement condemning the attack and condolences to the families. And, of course, Naftali Bennett is a right-winger in Israeli terms, and they've just killed scores of Palestinian children with sniper attacks. Is that terrorism? I think it is. Same sort of thing as what's happening in the synagogue, isn't it? Pot kettle black.
Let's move on now to talk about the Lion Air crash. This aircraft, which was a pretty much brand new 737, flies out of Jakarta, is a little bit wobbly on its ascent up to about 6,000 feet, and then nosedives at power into the sea. Now, Martin, I suppose this is more my thing than yours, but the era we're living in now is... surely we don't have to cope with an aircraft doing something like that. It's also feasible, and I've been looking at some of the articles about hacking aircraft, that aircraft can be hacked. In fact, there's a couple recently, one in Forbes and one in Newsweek. Kate O'Flaherty has done an article saying how to hack an aircraft in Forbes, and that was on the just about 6 weeks ago in Forbes magazine. And then the in-flight airplanes can now be hacked from the ground, cyber expert warns. Jason Murdoch in Newsweek is saying. What would normally happen in an air crash like that, or if something goes wrong with the aircraft, and we heard that there was something apparently on one of the previous flights, is that whatever is happens, the pilot can still control the ailerons, which are on the main wings, and the elevators, which are on the rear wings, which means that the aircraft can be, even if there's no power from the engines, can just be sort of glided down to sit on the ocean. But we then hear, by looking at the Jakarta Post, that there was a 20-man team of government people on board, many of whom were involved in the main audit team for Indonesia. Now, just tell us a bit about the political background in Indonesia, because I know many years ago there was a horrific coup which was organised by Henry Kissinger, and that actually it's now a totally corrupt country. So an audit team on that jet would have been almost certainly looking into some sort of corruption going on in the government. The owner of the airline actually works for the government as well. He's a diplomat. He's the Indonesian ambassador to Malaysia, who owns the airline. So I wonder here whether this could be a case of hacking.
Well, it might be. But I don't think there's much point jumping to conclusions about it. It's quite possible that that's what's gone on here. And don't forget, the aircraft on 9/11, I think they were hacked. Global Hawk technology has existed since the 1970s. A plane was flown all the way from the US to Australia without a pilot in 1971 or 72. And hacking of planes is quite straightforward from the ground. And, you know, it could easily be the case. Certainly on 9/11, I don't think they were piloted by the so-called hijackers.
Well, what sort of government is it in Indonesia?
This government is, it's basically a right-wing government, which is sort of with an Islamist flavour, and they are the people that have come to power since the coup in 1965, which were a million communists were executed in the coup. So a million people were killed by the Indonesian army, Kopassus, which is their version of the SAS. And of course they've also been caught out planting bombs. There's a suggestion that the Bali bomb was actually planted by Kopassus, who are, you know, basically working for the government. I think these are the sort of things that need to be investigated. So it's just making random accusations. But the fact is, the real world is run by criminals who operate through intelligence services, and not just the Russians and the Chinese, but the Western intelligence services have very, very dirty hands indeed, and that includes the Indonesians.
So the owner and the founder of Lion Air, he's a big businessman in Indonesia, but he's also the ambassador to Malaysia.
Well, that's pretty much par for the course in countries like Indonesia. And
you know what? Maybe here soon, because business people as diplomats, an utterly disastrous idea from Jeremy Hunt. This is Patrick Coburn writing yesterday in The Independent. British participation in the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya and Syria were partly the result of an amateurish foreign office. This ridiculous measure would undoubtedly harm future diplomatic efforts. The silly idea, Patrick Coburn says, of recruiting businessmen and other non-professionals into the foreign office is more menacing than it looks at first glance. It's a depressing signal that Jeremy Hunt, the Foreign Secretary, though promising dramatic increases in the numbers of British diplomats, has not really taken on board what's gone wrong in the past and what can be done to put it right. The main failings of British foreign policy over the last 2 years has been amateurism and wishful thinking, combined with a rather pathetic desire to retain great power status by piggybacking on American political and military strength. A great article, I thought. And also, of course, one of the things he's saying here is many of these wars, which have been mistaken by, we've been persuaded to do them by the big business lobby, by people like the Royal Institute for International Affairs, the Council on Foreign Relations, and the Bilderberg Group.
Well, all of those groups are, you know, coordinating bodies for the oligarchy that actually runs our society.
So what Jeremy Hunt is saying is that some of these big business people should become our ambassador to the United States.
Well, the US has always had ambassadors. US ambassadors are basically political appointees, and they're people who've given a load of money You know, Trump's ambassadors will be people who gave him a load of money to get elected. British ambassadors, in theory, are supposed to be career professionals. And you've got people like Peter Ford, who used to be the ambassador to Syria, who's spoken up very, very eloquently about British policy in Syria in opposition to it. So our support for jihadism, our support for Al-Qaeda. And, of course, our very own Craig Murray, who resigned or was forced out of the Foreign Office because he exposed the torture that was going on in Uzbekistan and basically supported by the British. And I'm afraid it's a dirty old game out there.
Lion Air Chief Executive Officer Edward Sirat told reporters the same aircraft had experienced a technical issue the night before. So if the boss of an airline is also a diplomat, that does mean that they may be, actually part of a... There may be some motives or whatever to stop an investigation into the government by the audit committee.
You've raised that issue, and it's certainly something. If there was an independent police investigation of this in Indonesia, that's the sort of thing they should be thinking about.
Do not do this. They do not do power crash dives into the sea. The pilot would have been quite well aware that if there were problems with it, he still should be able to do the very basic things. There's a whole load of redundancy where he should be able to tip the plane one way or the other, using the ailerons on the end, ends of the main wings, and he should be able to tip the front and the of the plane up and down still, using the elevators at the back. So this aircraft should never have crashed in this way, and I'm absolutely shocked to see so little criticism and coverage of it, although there has been on some of the internet forums, like Professional Pilots Rumour Network, people like that are saying, well, this is extraordinary that a brand new aircraft can just do a power dive into the sea from 6,000 feet.
Well, all of the pilots for 9/11 Truth have been pointing out that the story on 9/11 simply doesn't add up. The most significant political action of the 21st century, and it's basically a lie, as anybody who knows anything about aerospace will tell you.
And have a look at Loose Change. That's one of the best films on it, as a sort of quick intro to the 9/11 cover up conspiracy, whatever you want to call it. Anyhow, Martin, also with the death of journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, there seems to have been a bit of a shift and more discussion now about what on earth are the Saudis up to in Yemen, and that was brought up at Prime Minister's Questions.
Mr. Andrew Mitchell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Following the welcome call overnight from the American administration for the ending of the Saudi bombing campaign in Yemen, will my right honourable friend use Britain's undoubted authority at the United Nations to press for a new Security Council resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire and meaningful and inclusive negotiations to end what is the worst and most terrifying humanitarian catastrophe on the planet?
Well, and I thank my honourable friend, my right honourable friend, who I know has been consistent in pressing on the needs of the people of Yemen. And we certainly back the US's call for de-escalation in Yemen. He references our role in the United Nations Security Council. In fact, in March, we proposed and coordinated a UN Security Council presidential statement which called on the parties to agree steps towards a ceasefire. This remains our position. But as my right honourable friend, the Minister, said in the House, I believe, yesterday, a nationwide ceasefire will only have an effect on the ground if it is underpinned by a political deal between the conflict parties. And my right honourable friend, the Foreign Secretary, discussed this matter with Martin Griffiths, the UN's Special Envoy, last night. They agreed that the UK will continue to encourage all parties to agree to de-escalation and to that lasting political deal which will ensure that any ceasefire will hold in the long term.
Martin, looks like the West's proxy war using the Saudis is maybe not quite so popular as it used to be here in the West now after the murder of Khashoggi.
Well, that's possibly the only positive thing that may come out of his murder, is that it's brought Yemen to the centre of the political debate. But, of course, the fact is that the British and the Americans, our military personnel, are over there helping the Saudis to bomb Yemen back into the Stone Age. And what's happening now, Pompeo's discussion of what let's have a ceasefire and negotiations, that's basically, I think, just a cover-up. There isn't going to be any negotiation and there isn't going to be any ceasefire, but we can pretend that we called for a ceasefire even as we carry on supplying weaponry and our personnel are involved in killing Yemeni children. And incidentally, of course, British military personnel are operating in Saudi Arabia. If the Anasrullah people were able to kill them, then they'd be absolutely within their rights to do so. Send them home in body bags. We've got November the 11th coming up next week. I'm not a pacifist. If British military personnel are involved in bombing children, then somebody needs to take them out. And no crying for mummies.
Also, Martin, this week hasn't got a lot of coverage, but Kosovo has moved to create their own army as Serbia warns of a threat to peace this week. Kosovo has taken the first steps towards creating its own army 10 years after it declared independence, despite fierce opposition from the ethnic Serb minority and Serbia itself, which called the move a threat to peace since the end of the 1998-99 war between Serbia's armed forces and pro-independence ethnic Albanian guerrillas. NATO-led international forces, KFOR, had been tasked with securing security in Kosovo. More than 4,000 KFOR troops currently deployed throughout the breakaway territory, whose independence is recognised by more than 110 countries, but not by Serbia, which still considers it to be its southern province.
Not by Spain either, because it would set a precedent for Catalonia. Not by India either, because it would set a precedent for Kashmir. Kosovo was an autonomous region of Serbia under the Yugoslav constitution. So they're not going to get a seat at the United Nations, and they're not going to be an independent country any more than Kurdistan is going to be recognised as an independent country in Turkey.
They're already recognised by 110
countries. No, but that doesn't mean you get a seat at the United Nations. 110 countries can recognise you, but you have to be unanimously recognised to get the seat at the United Nations. And of course, if you're not an independent country, you can't have an independent army. That's what the Serbs would say.
Now, you were over in Yugoslavia quite a lot, weren't you? Didn't you have some sort of a role with the Kosovo?
No, well,
didn't
no.
You have some sort of conversations?
No. What was happening at the time, Tony? I talked to everybody from all sides. That was my job. So I spoke to the opposition, as it then was in Kosovo. Adam Demaci was the moderate opposition. Hafsin Thaci, who is now the prime minister, he was the Kosovo Liberation Army guy. The Kosovo Liberation Army were a classic terrorist stroke freedom fighter organisation. They killed quite a lot of people.
Did you have sympathies for them?
At the time, I had sympathies for everybody in the situation. I was working quite closely with the Bosnian Army, who I met Oracevic, who was second in command of the Bosnian Army inside Mostar, because I was one of the first people in there after the ceasefire after 18 months. Pretty horrific stuff. The whole breakup of Yugoslavia was orchestrated by the Western powers because they didn't want an independent Yugoslavia to continue existing. And they've managed. Don't forget, when we went to war over Kosovo on what looks like false pretenses now, there wasn't, in fact, a big massacre going on, although at the time I thought there was. It turns out that in fact it was much more two-sided than the impressions we got. And there was a 73-day bombing campaign coordinated by the RAF and the Americans, killed 10,000 civilians. Do you remember we bombed Belgrade TV station to kill their weather girls? Because apparently they were propaganda.
Didn't the Chinese TV station
The Chinese embassy was also well. Bombed, and the Chinese didn't think that was an accident. And it wasn't an accident. It was deliberate. Because I'm afraid the West is run by war mongers.
When you were over there, you were working for CAFOD, weren't you?
I was working for the Catholic Fund for Overseas Development, yeah.
And, I mean, looking back on it now, do you think that they had a glorious role in it, or do you think...
The Catholic Church in Croatia were very politicised, and they were very involved in the conflict.
Weren't they quite fascistic, actually?
Some of them were, some of them weren't. I'm not going to point the finger at everybody.
I mean, many of the
fascists... Many of the fascists
in Croatia identified themselves as Catholics, didn't they?
Well, the Croatian Catholic fascists do exist. Croatian Catholics who are not fascists also exist. I mean, there is extremism on all sides, and don't forget, in Yugoslavia, you've got more than one community. You've got a plethora of communities, at least 10 or 11 communities, all of whom have got extreme elements within them, and with the consequences that we all saw at the time. And of course, the country is still a basket case after all these years. It's not gone anywhere really. The overt killing is finished, but the place is still ruined.
So, do you think Kosovo should have its own army or not? I think at the time you thought it did, didn't you?
Well. I think the fact is they've got their own army. You can't stop them having their own army. The question is, are the British going to arm and train this army? Yeah? They'll be trained by NATO. Now, that's the question, because if you train that army, then it's your army you've trained, and if they then go on to carry out atrocities, for example, against Serbian civilians, then you're responsible for what happens, aren't you?
What do you think is the likely outcome of all this, then? Will they get what they want?
The danger in Yugoslavia is that as we move towards a dangerous geopolitical confrontation with Russia, and as the economy takes a nosedive in Europe, is that the whole war could restart.
Is that really feasible?
It's perfectly feasible, because everybody's still armed to the teeth. There's just been an armed truce, effectively, since the war finished. And there's no reason at all why it couldn't restart if people are stupid enough to restart it.
Right, so Yugoslavia, what would the country be like now if NATO hadn't intervened? I mean, it sounds like a crazy question, but I've got to ask it, because what I've seen of Yugoslavia up until the 1990s, when all this horrific stuff happened, is actually it was quite a model economy. It was quite successful. People were happy there. It was a great place to go on holiday, and there was quite a lot of worker control over very successful industries. It was a successful model in many many ways, of socialist society, which wasn't under the thrall of the rather more draconian system that they had over in the Soviet Union.
Yes, I think there were features of the Yugoslav model which were very attractive, but you can't. It wasn't necessarily as efficient as you might think. And the other problem was the thing that they did is they borrowed a lot of money from the West in order to grease the wheels of, you know, keep the show on the road. And of course, once they were in debt, they were then in a position where the outside powers, effectively the Western powers, to whom they were in debt, can destabilise the country for their own reasons. And that's exactly what they did. I spoke to somebody with the former Bulgarian foreign minister in Sofia during that era, and he said to me, well, my assessment is that the Americans and the British have deliberately destabilised Yugoslavia. And I wasn't really willing to accept that at the time. I said, well, they've made a complete mess of it, but I don't think they've done it deliberately. But looking back on it, I think, and everything that's happened since, with the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan and 9/11 and all the rest of it, you suddenly think, well, actually, I mean, it's not unreasonable to suggest that the Western powers did destabilise Yugoslavia quite deliberately for their own reasons.
Do you have any regrets personally about what you did over there?
Not really, no. I did what I had to do at the time. One of the things that was asked to do by CAFOD was to apply to the British government for £3 million for our programme over there. And in actual fact, I couldn't find enough good stuff to spend the £1 million we'd already spent. So I wrote the letter because I was told to, but the British government quite sensibly said, well, no, we're not going to give you £3 million more, because basically aid agencies have got their own agenda, which is to get money to spend. But you've got to have good, useful things to spend it on. And of course, it was quite difficult to find useful things to spend it on in the middle of a war. We could spend it all on food aid, and we did spend it a lot. Most of the money we spent was spent on food aid, and we also did some key projects where we tried to bring communities together. But it was, it was a learning experience for everybody, and it was a hell of a mess, and it's still a hell of a mess.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, he who controls the present controls the past. He who controls the past controls the future. We're going to have a listen now to David Livingstone, who's an author on one of his most recent ones, books is about transhumanism. And we heard from him, I think, about 8 months ago or so. But I thought we'd revisit another part of that interview, which is where I talked to him, or where he talks to us, about the whole idea of rewriting history. David Livingstone.
The propaganda version of the history of Western civilization is really an attempt to secularize the occult version of history. So the conventional interpretation is that Greece was the cradle of Western civilization. So the common narrative is that it begins in Greece, evolves to Rome, and there's a dark period of a dark age, and then a rebirth in the Renaissance, and then the Enlightenment, and then modern times. So because it's being presented as the history of secularism. Greek philosophy is presented in the first attempts to veer away from religious interpretations. So what I've discovered is basically that Greek philosophy actually was born in Ionia, which is the western coast of Turkey, which was at that time, beginning in the 6th to the 3rd century, approximately, I guess, BC, it was under Persian occupation. So what I trace it all back to is that basically I trace the occult back into Babylon in the 6th century BC. What happens then is that there's the cult of the Magi, the same Magi who supposedly came to visit Jesus. But the reality is that there were different Magi. So the Magi, and they're the ones that the word magic comes from. They're basically renowned experts in occult arts, particularly magic and astrology. And the confusion is that conventionally, the Magi were supposed to be priests of Zoroastrianism, which is the official religion of the Persian Empire. So this is a key point of history that's been missed by, I think, most conventional historians. But it was highlighted by Frantz Cumont. Frantz Cumont is a Belgian historian, and he's the one who identified the emergence of these early occult traditions with the Magi, but he characterized them as heretical Zoroastrianism or heretical Zoroastrians. Frantz Cumont, he's in my estimation probably the greatest scholar of the 20th century. And one of the main reasons why he's so important is because his expertise was in the study of Mithraism. And anyone who's studied the external influences to Christianity, or basically pagan influences, knows that Mithraism was one of the key, or probably the key influence. It was one of the most important pagan cults of the Roman Empire, practiced by emperors and the army. And it's studying that particular mystery cult tradition which is really the key to understanding the entire course of Western occultism after that. So what's important is that, as I mentioned, you have these heretical magi who emerged in the 6th century, in Babylon, in 6th century BC, and what they did is they mixed a heretical version of Zoroastrianism with Babylonian magic and astrology. And so this cult then becomes highly influential. And with the expansion of the Persian Empire, these magi bring their practices to various parts of the world, most importantly to Egypt, where it evolves into Hermeticism, and then in Greece, where it becomes basically Greek philosophy. So the most important exponents of that are Pythagoras and, of course, his protege Plato.
Now, you're talking about the occult. For a lot of people, this kind of means things like witchcraft and something dark, maybe. But as Dionne Fortune pointed out in her book, The Esoteric Orders and Their Work, although, I mean, she was a theosophist and wrote quite a lot about magic, this kind of thing, she points out that there's two sides to this. There's the occult, which is kind of secret operations. In other words, secret societies moving events from behind the scenes, you know, with kind of secret alliances, for example, between different parts of government, the press, the political parties, the judiciary, secretly, you know, working together behind the scenes. And there's this other side as well, which is mysticism, which is the idea that, you know, you're kind of being sold myths and a kind of a faith, religion. So you've talked a bit about the occult and the background to that in history. What about the other side, the mysticism?
For Dionne Fortune to talk about that, she's, I would say, a little biased, right? So she, I don't think there is such a distinction. I mean, mysticism is occultism. So
I suppose what I'm saying is the mysticism is out in the open, but the occultism is behind the scenes. Yeah, so there's a sort of,
I suppose.
Yeah?
I mean, it depends what you characterize as mysticism. I mean, from what I've seen, mysticism has been, for scholars, one of the most difficult things to define and characterize. So, I mean, really, the mysticism comes from the occult and has been very closely aligned to it from the beginning. So,
yeah. So, I'm just thinking that, you know, most of the major faiths, like there's a kind of mystic Judaism, there's a kind of mystic Christianity, mystic Islam, which is, I suppose, a kind of alternative version from what the Quran says, the Old Testament, the New Testament say.
That's an important point. So what you get these days, and this is important for the history of transhumanism, is fascism, the philosophy of René Guénon. And so Guénon basically says that, and he converted to Islam because he believed that all exoteric religions shared a similar common tradition, which was a mystical tradition. So he believed that you could follow any religion because it didn't really matter, because it was really just the outward exterior of the kernel, which was mystical tradition. And this is an idea that dates back to the Renaissance, to what they used to call the Prisca Theologi, or the ancient wisdom. And so the Renaissance really was marked by a rediscovery of Hermeticism. And this is why it's really important to understand the French Quimons' discoveries and the origins of Mithraism. Because what happens, especially in Hellenistic times, basically in Roman times, the real hub, the cultural hub of the world, the political hub of the world was the city of Rome, but the cultural hub was the city of Alexandria. And there you had all kinds of traditions that were mixed there. So that's where you had Jews, you had Gnostic Christians, you had Hermeticism, mystery cults, various pagan mysteries like the mysteries of Isis, Osiris, and so on and so forth. And it's really out of that cauldron that you get the development of the original fundamental traditions of the Western occult tradition, which is Hermeticism, Neoplatonism, and the ancient mysteries.
But we don't see these terms really discussed, do we, much by people who would call themselves today either religious leaders or philosophers?
No, exactly, and that's kind of the problem. And this is why Western civilization is basically a whitewash, which it basically omits most of the important developments, the ideological developments that shaped Western civilization. So those are the key ones. Like, you can't understand the Renaissance without understanding the history of the occult. And this is great. There's a great book on the subject by Jean Sesnick. It's called The Survival of the Pagan Gods. And, I mean, there's other tangents here, but basically it's a rediscovery of Hermeticism and particularly astrological magic.
Martin, what he's saying effectively is that the academics, Oxford University, Bristol University, have actually got it wrong, that most of the real influence of Western civilization is from Babylon, not from Greece.
Well, I think in actual fact, if you actually look at the mainstream scholarship in this field, you will see that that is exactly the mainstream view. The Greeks didn't invent all this stuff out of nothing. What usually happens in history, and is still happening now, is people find what was there before, and they rework it, and every generation reworks the stuff that they find, and that is actually the case. The Greeks didn't come fully sprung out of the head of Zeus like Athena. Most of their ideas were obviously picked up from previous civilizations. So in other words, this is basically just saying what I've just heard basically is saying what is that is pretty much the mainstream view. And the idea that somebody's hiding something and that nobody's facing up to the fact that all these ideas are hermetic and they're all related, well, nobody's saying anything different.
Okay.
I mean, throughout history we've said that.
What about this? There's a new story today. The human brain supercomputer switched on to unlock the secrets of the mind. This is Anthony Cuthbertson in The Independent. We've essentially created a machine that works more like a brain than a traditional computer, which is extremely exciting, says Professor Steve Ferber. After 12 years of construction and £15 million in funding, a giant computer designed to mimic the human brain is ready to be switched on today. Built by the University of Manchester, the Spinnaker machine is made up of 1 million processors capable of 200 trillion actions per second.
Well, as our friend Kevin Cahill pointed out, because he works for Computer World, the country with the biggest number of supercomputers is China, and they've got more than the West.
No, but it's not designed to work like a human mind.
Isn't it?
Anyway,
this is marketing. This is marketing puff
anyway,
for this computer, isn't it?
We won't have time. I'm sorry again for our little thing on the East India Company. But what we will have time for is David Livingston talking about computers mimicking the mind.
It's important because it's totalitarianism, and it is the attempt to rule us with a particular type of rule.
But I mean, Google, surely. I mean, it's a kind of friendly sort of smiling faces on the Google when you get it, bring it up on the internet.
Yeah. Well, see, what's really interesting is that the internet, so if you go all the way back to Norbert Wiener, the goal of creating artificial intelligence was for them to become gods, to create an all-seeing eye. And the computer and both the computer and internet were entirely projects of the CIA. So the cybernetics group really that basically dictated the direction for this project was intertwined with the CIA. And what's interesting is out of the cybernetics group came two fundamental projects. So one was the creation of personal computer, and the other one was MKUltra, which is basically it's commonly characterized as a mind control program, but it had many facets to it. One of the key facets of it was the use of drugs for population control, led largely by Aldous Huxley. And I think, you know, his Brave New World gives us enough of a clue of what the goal there was. So from the beginning, it's been this plan to create not only artificial intelligence, but a global computer and internet. So if you listen to in fact, what's really important here is a lot of these transhumanism and the Yeah, I guess the transhumanists, they follow, in particular, the computer culture, sort of the ideology behind the computer culture is Pierre de Teilhard de Chardin. He's a Jesuit philosopher, and he predicted the development of what he called the noosphere. And the noosphere is basically a step in human evolution where the humans evolved to create a collective mind. So that's pretty much what they're seeing. So what would... I mean, if we extrapolate from what they're expressing now, then their goal is to create this global computer that sees all, sees everything. And according to Francis Heylin, because what Francis Heylin says that, you know, religions have failed us, most ideologies have failed us, and the world is in chaos, and we now need something to unite us. And he said that if we can create this artificial intelligence and this global mind, then humanity will finally have something to worship.
There is one other side to this, and many people say that the internet was actually just a development of a communication system which was designed to protect against nuclear attack, where, you know, you'd get many different methods of getting from A to B on the communications. You know, a network is much more efficient than a sort of communication line running just from A to B to C. You know, if one part of that network goes down or is nuked, then there's plenty of other ways that the messages can get around the network. And in a way, that does work, doesn't it, to sort of stop censorship. So when censorship happens on the internet, there are other ways, you know, the internet kind of routes around it.
Well, you know, I mean, I always say that, you know, the technology is it's morally independent, right? It's not if fire can create or it can destroy. So it's the same thing with the internet. It's just a technology. It all depends on how they use it. It was created for a totalitarian goal, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we have to throw it out.
So what do you believe personally? You keep talking about them. You're obviously not one of them.
I believe in what they...
Sorry, we'll have to... I don't know how that shouldn't have left that little bit on the end there. Martin, what do you make of this? I mean, it's interesting that this is all happening on the day the human brain supercomputer has been switched on in Manchester. They say it's a whole new different type of computer.
Well, these are aspirations, but whether they'll ever be fulfilled is another matter. If there's a nuclear exchange, even a minor one, this will all be irrelevant.
Time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 8. This week, oneword.org.uk is our show page. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Please do join us for the Politics Show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
Online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.